Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report Bob Lytan, who I consider one of the most accomplished economists of our generation. And I think one of the reasons is his breadth of experience is very unique. He's been a practicing attorney. He's an economist. He's been a government official both at the Department of Justice and the Office of Management and Budget, and has a very good understanding of the federal budget and credit and how it intersects with the economy. He's also been an entrepreneur, and I think most impressive to me is he has contributed to extraordinary research. He, for many years, was head of the Kauffman Foundation research effort into the entrepreneurial process. And if you look at any discussion of the U.S. economy, particularly revitalizing or strengthening the U.S. economy, he's got the broadest of experiences and knowledge and can really think cross-sector in a way which I think is very unusual. So, Bob, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Thank you very much. That was overly generous.
Well, sometimes I think that you work so hard and so fast that you forget what you've managed to accomplish. You know, I rarely deal with anybody who has dipped into so many different parts of the economy as you have. So how is it that you came up with such a unique background?
By accident. I think most people's careers develop that way. And then, you know, I view a lot of the stuff that I do like baking a cake. It's the way I write books, the way I write articles. I work just a little bit each day on writing. And if you write two or three pages a day, and if you're able to do that over 365 days, you got 700 pages. So you can turn out a lot of stuff.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about two of your books today, and I just wanted to introduce them. The first is Trillion Dollar Economists, How Economists and Their Ideas Have Transformed Business, and then Better Capitalism, Renewing the Entrepreneurial Strength of the American Economy. But we're going to start with Trillion Dollar Economists. And I have to tell you, if somebody had said, what's Lytan going to write next? I would not have predicted that you were going to write a book about Trillion Dollar Economists. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about why you decided to do it, how you came to it.
So I've spent most of my career writing policy stuff, and you're absolutely right. I wouldn't have predicted this 4 or 5 years ago. But I did it for several reasons. Number one is after the 2008 financial crisis, I saw that a lot of economists were being blamed for not having foreseen the crisis. In addition, during the course of my career, especially at Kauffman, I ran into many business people who charitably, I would say, did not have a great view of economists. They thought we were all ivory tower people and hadn't met a payroll. That rubbed me the wrong way. And third, one of my terrific kids, who's now getting her PhD in biochemistry, she took some undergraduate economics courses at the University of Rochester. Very mathematical, you know, very high-level economics. And yet when she came back to me and would talk to me, she would show, like many other undergraduates who've gone through economics training, that they may not be able to read the Wall Street Journal. I mean, they could solve equations and know all the graphs on the boards, but they wouldn't have any practical application of economics. So I decided to write a book for all three of these audiences, for college people, for college students in particular, for business people, and for the larger public that has this, I think, unwarranted view of economists as forecasters, when in fact a lot of the economic ideas and the people who've come up with them have contributed very importantly to business, and I wanted to show in a concrete way, without a lot of equations and graphs, in fact, I don't think I have any in the book, exactly why that's true, and that if you add it all up, economists have contributed at least $1 trillion to the economy and probably more.
Right. Well, one of the examples you use that I don't want to get into deeply, but I think a lot of people know, is the Moneyball example. And you point out that the Moneyball phenomena in baseball has translated into a whole new field of sports economics.
Right. In fact, the field actually has an academic discipline called sabermetrics now. And there's an annual conference every year at MIT that attracts all these sports geeks who know a lot about computers and analytics. And this conference at MIT attracts like 2,000 people, plus all the general managers of a lot of the teams, so that whether it's baseball or football or basketball or football, everyone's into analytics, and that all started from a guy from Kansas, where I'm from, Bill James, who is sort of the Bible, who wrote the Bible on economics, on sports statistics, also applied some very basic economic and statistical techniques to trying to predict player performance. He did this in the 1980s, and now it's developed to a whole enormous field that is actually used by the teams.
Well, you used a lot of fascinating examples and case studies, but I have to tell you the one that was nearest and dearest to my heart that I thought we'd talk about today was the trains, planes, and trucks. Or I guess you had it. You might have had a trucks plane. I don't know which way you had it. But part of the reason it's hard to understand the contribution of economists to that, to the deregulation of the transportation infrastructure, is, you know, you're talking about something that crosses the private sector, it crosses the government, it crosses law. It's very, you know, traditionally when you read descriptions of this, it's very hard to follow. And yours is very, it's very clear, it's very coherent, it's very easy to begin to understand how that deregulation just teed up an infrastructure platform that made an enormous difference to the economy, and still is. So maybe if you could just describe what happened and the contribution economists made, because I think it's an excellent example.
So a lot of our listeners probably won't have a memory of this, but before the 1980s, every airfare and every truck fare and every route had to be approved by the federal government, all dated from the Depression. And the theory was that excessive competition in air and also in trucks would somehow, you know, make the industry non-competitive, and eventually there'd be excessive competition. So we regulated these industries like crazy, and it led to enormous inefficiency and to fares that were ridiculously high by modern comparison, and to trucks that would go in one direction full and then come back empty. So highly inefficient. And in the 1970s and 80s, late 70s, through the Carter administration appointees, who were all economists, we eventually got rid of all this. And eventually these economists persuaded not only the administration but Congress to adopt a deregulation bill for both air and trucks. And so today we have a totally deregulated industry. Now, people may complain about airline traffic because the air industry is now, in my opinion, too concentrated because we allowed too many mergers. But before we got there, and certainly in the trucking industry, we have lots and lots of competition. We don't have the situation where trucks are going one way and then coming back empty. And we have very efficient national transportation companies. They're called UPS and FedEx that are actually integrated, both air and truck. And we have 24/7 pickup, and I make the point in the book that Amazon could not have gotten started if it had had to rely on the post office to deliver all of its packages. I mean, just think about it. I mean, they would have never gotten started, but they were able to take advantage of this highly sophisticated and developed transportation infrastructure, UPS and FedEx and other modes of delivery, that were all made possible by the deregulation of the late
1970s. Right, and just-in-time manufacturing, too. Things that a lot less visible to the retail customer, but had a very dramatic impact on the economy.
Yeah, and that couldn't have happened without trucking deregulation, because the routes would have been all regulated, and each time you had to go someplace different, you'd have to get approval. And of course, this is ridiculous. It's antithetical to the whole idea of just in time.
Right. One of the things you point out towards the end of $1 trillion economists is the revolution that's happening in economics. And before we go on to the renewal part, I'd just love for you to touch on that a little bit.
Well, you know, in the days when I was growing up being an economist, the thing that was probably most valued was highly theoretical, mathematical writings. They're the kind of things that got Nobel Prizes and so forth. And I think the industry or the field sort of exhausted itself of that. And we have a whole new generation of scholars today who are very facile with analyzing very large databases. So this is the world of big data in economics. It's also true in the private sector with banks and internet companies and phone companies. They have all this huge amounts of data, and they apply analytics to it. And I think the future of economics lies in the very sophisticated analysis of all these large bodies of data. As a result, we're going to have a merging of economics with statistics, computer science, and with other fields in social science. It really, in a way, doesn't matter whether you're an economist or social science, or a political scientist or a sociologist. If you have a mass of data, what you do is you apply a hypothesis to how that data is structured, and you analyze what seems to be causing what. And I think that's the direction in which economics is headed. And there's some very well-known people. One of the best economists in this field is a guy named Raj Chetty. Raj is a professor at Harvard, and he just won one of the most prestigious awards in economics, the Clark Medal. And he has made a career out of analyzing mobility statistics, for example, to, in other words, predict the probability if you're born to a family of a certain income, what's the probability that you will rise in your income level over the course of your life? And he's shown that probability varies hugely, not only where you're born, what income class you're born into, but also by geography, where you're born, and there's a huge variation across the United States. Well, I could multiply those examples by manyfold, but that's the future of economics, it seems to me.
One of the things I think it's hard for many Americans to believe is, but I've seen it happen, and your book describes it, is that sometimes when a group of economists or researchers come up with a very grounded, sound analysis and present the facts, policymakers will really change things. I mean, it's the back to the planes and trucks and trains for a second. You describe how remarkable it was that we got this kind of deregulation in a democratic administration. But what you describe is, you know, a group of economists bringing in the facts, and literally the policymakers, whether in Congress or in the administration, looking at them and it being sufficiently compelling that they decide to do anything. So I think, you know, facts sometimes can really beat ideology. It's quite remarkable.
I think it's true, and I think we have a history of that. Unfortunately, in the current political environment, it doesn't seem to be true, because if we look at both parties, and I think we have so far a relatively economics-free or fact-free race on both the Republican and the Democratic side. The two have moved both to the extremes on both, and they don't seem to be listening to many mainstream economists. And by the way, it's in part because of this very bad reputation that economists got for failing to predict the 2008 financial crisis, even though 98% of economists don't even pretend to forecast. That's not what they do. They try to figure out.
Right. Forecasting is not the job of an economist.
Right. But that's the possible perception of it. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about better capitalism, because I'm convinced that, quality economics and analytics can somehow intercede into the policy debate, even if it's only bottom up. Talk a little bit about your research at Kauffman, because that's the part of your work that I have found fascinating. We've published a lot of it on the Solari report. So maybe if you could describe why you went to Kauffman and what you oversaw and some of the research that came out of that effort.
Well, I went to Kauffman in my early 50s, was there about a decade. Kauffman was not a big name in research before I got there, and I was fortunate to get there at a time when I had a president who was willing to tolerate and let me run loose in engaging a lot of very top-tier economists to write about the contribution and the importance of entrepreneurship to economic growth. And over the next decade, we published a lot of stuff and also funded a lot of stuff to prove this. And now it's sort of mainstream. And by the way, this is common sense if you're an entrepreneur, especially, all those high-tech entrepreneurs. They know they're reinventing the world. We went along and helped document it. And we started tracking a lot of things. And one of the very disturbing things about the current U.S. economy is that we've had a noticeable drop-off in what we call the startup rate. This would be the ratio of new firms that have at least one employee to all firms. And that startup rate has fallen, especially since the 2008 recession. And if we want to have fast growth in the future, we have to find a way to get that rate back up again and also encourage firms that seem to be starting, encourage their growth. And that's, to me, one of the most important public policy challenges we have. By the way, it's been briefly mentioned in the Republican national debates, There's been a lot of reference to this statistic that we now have more firms dying than being started. That actually came from a paper that I wrote with Ian Hathaway for Brookings a couple of years ago. That number, by the way, has turned around a little bit from the latest data. It turns out that births now exceed deaths slightly. But the candidates are still making the fundamental point that we had this noticeable drop in births, and it fell so far that for a period of time, more businesses were dying than were being formed, and that is worrisome.
Right, and I don't know necessarily what the statistics are, but I travel a fair amount. We have subscribers all over the world, and it certainly looks to me like there are economies around the world that are much more dynamic that way than we are, and that's disturbing.
Well, they're certainly catching up, and they've caught the U.S. model, and they're learning how to replicate what we did.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about some of the things we might do. So, you know, we are coming into a period when a year or so from now, somebody's going to ask, okay, well, what's the action? What do we do? You had, in Better Capitalism, you outlined a series of ideas of different things we could do, and we certainly don't have time to go through all of them. I encourage everybody to get the book, but maybe if we could touch on some of them quickly. Reducing, removing double taxation, that's a big one of mine from long ago. I've been beating that drum for a long time, and it puts everyone to sleep.
Yeah. And politically, it's probably not possible, although there are a number of tax plans out there that would significantly reduce corporate taxes, which would help, although that's meant largely to help established companies more than
right.
startups.
But I'm a great believer in equity financing, and you have a discrimination of equity versus debt, and I think, you know, it continues to plague us, and you know, and so to me, at some point, we have to address it. Research R&D credit. Maybe if you could say a word or two about that.
Well, I'd say in general, it's a good idea, although it will probably not help startups because they don't
right.
have the income. So,
right.
But in general, you know, as you know, this credit has been in the tax code for, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 decades, but it lapses every year or two. So they have to put it up for, you know, renewal, and it creates an immense amount of uncertainty. And, of course, we know the reason why Congress writes it so that it lapses. That way they can perpetually hit people up for campaign contributions. I mean, that's
right.
the reason it's written that way, and it's shameful.
Right.
So,
I think one of the most important is the idea of, which you bring up, of diploma visas for graduates or, you know, easier rules in terms of green cards, because there's no doubt that, you know, so much growth comes from talented entrepreneurs.
Yes, and so let me talk about that. That is probably the most important recommendation, and the current political environment is the one that needs to be stressed the most. So there's research that Kauffman funded that has since documented that immigrants account for a disproportionate number of our high-tech startups and for a disproportionate number of our patents. And so common sense would tell you all those immigrants that are coming here to get STEM degrees, for example, at U.S. universities that are being sent back, is cutting off our nose by our face. We're committing, I mean, it's malpractice to basically take people
right.
in and send them
right.
home. So first, we ought to keep these people. And secondly, we ought to have a much more liberal rules for immigrant entrepreneurs. And unfortunately, these two ideas, which would do more, in my opinion, to contribute to a turnaround of the startup rate than anything, these two ideas now are probably politically dead because of all the hysteria over immigration in general. And so they've gotten swept up in the fear about refugees, in the fear about Mexican immigrants, the so-called wall that Donald Trump wants to put up, and so forth. And as a result, this is the worst possible political environment for trying to correct something which should have been corrected 10 or 15 years ago.
Now, it looks as though Paul Ryan is focused on this and is trying to at least loosen up some of the visa requirements.
Yes, but even he has said more or less that he's probably not going to tackle immigration reform until...
It's too dangerous.
It's too dangerous. He probably won't do it until they do something on the border, until maybe 2017,
right.
and who knows how long it'll be after that. And it's been, in my opinion, we've lost at least a decade. And
right.
Kauffman research has since documented that GDP growth would be much higher if we had had, you know, more liberal policies allowing these people in. And by the way, I think even pre all this hysteria, if you ask the average person in the street, you know, should we let in entrepreneurs from other countries, and should we basically keep our STEM graduates here so that they can start new businesses? I think most people would say, yeah, those are the people we want. Well, of course we
exactly.
want
them. You know, yeah,
and,
exactly.
And the notion that we would kick them out is ridiculous.
Right. Well, it's funny. After I read your book, I was I went in to see Graceland with some tourists. You know, if you live near Memphis, you go to Graceland a lot, which I love because I love Elvis Presley. And what I realized, I was tootling around Memphis, and I realized, you know, if it wasn't for Elvis Presley and Fred Smith, I can't imagine what would have happened to Memphis. And so as I was reading your discussion of growth economics, I thought, okay, well, you need to get Elvis Presley and Fred Smith and the guy who started Sun Records, you need to get about, 2,000, 4,000 potentials. How do you do that? Well, that's why this is such a, you know, this is a no-brainer, as you said. So one of the things you talked about was the role of education, because I think part of the politics of letting letting people coming here or entrepreneurs coming here stay is fairness to the people who are here.
Right.
And to me, that comes down to a great education. And you have some great ideas for education. In my opinion, education is going the opposite direction since you wrote that. But so education reform, I don't know what there is to say other than it's unbelievably important. And if anything, it's going the wrong way.
Well, I will say a word about one thing, and that is choice in schools at the K through 12 level. We have a number of states now that have relatively good laws on charter schools, which operate unburdened of local bureaucracies. And there are a number of very, very good national networks in charter schools that are the good ones. And I'm not saying that every charter school is great, because they aren't, but there are some that are excellent and do a much better job educating, especially kids from low-income and minority backgrounds, than our regular public schools. And charter schools, by the way, are public schools. And I think one of the things that we could do, that we do more to help income inequality and address all this anxiety about unfairness, is to have a lot more competition in K through 12 education. And it's something that's been bipartisan until recently. Namely, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama both supported charter schools. A lot of Republicans supported charter schools. I was very disappointed to see Hillary Clinton move backwards in this direction recently. I'm hoping that at least federal policy will continue after 2017 being encouraging to charter schools. In the meanwhile, states can do this on their own. And Alabama, for example, just recently passed a law that would make it much easier to start charter schools. If Alabama can do it, certainly other states can do it.
But can that choice come without the Common Core and the testing requirements?
Yes. You still need the testing requirements. We need the testing requirements only because we have to track kids and know how well they're doing. But the short answer is that with good charter schools like KIPP or Success Academy and their other chains, they do a better job of this than conventional public schools, because they don't live by the rules that a lot of other that burden conventional public schools. Plus, they make their kids attend more hours of school than regular schools. And, you know, more time on task is eventually going to produce better results. And these schools have a record of doing that.
Okay, well, it's a rabbit hole. I don't want to go down it today, but you know, clearly, without excellence in education, I don't see how you get there. I won't go into healthcare, but I do think one of the things that has shocked me the most, you know, once upon a time I lived in New York and Washington, now I live in a rural Tennessee community, is the deterioration of the food and nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for many different reasons, but without a healthy population, I don't see how you know, without a strong body and a clear mind, a kid can't get a good education. So there's clearly a connection between healthcare and education. And
right,
it's all part of...
Absolutely. Okay. All I want to say is that before Obamacare was passed, one of the big complaints of a lot of the entrepreneurs I ran into, either people in their 30s or 40s, is that they left their company and started a new company and they had a pre-existing condition, they couldn't get health insurance. So
right.
At least Obamacare fixed that. Okay, so may or may not like Obamacare, but all I can say is if we replace it with something, we've got to keep the provision in it that does not allow discrimination on pre-existing conditions. But if you do that, you have to find a way to make it economical. And the Obama administration, like Massachusetts, said, well, we'll have an individual mandate to say that everybody has to be in a pool. If you don't have something like that, or you don't subsidize the insurance companies for taking on high-risk patients, then you won't be able to have insurance companies provide health care without pre-existing conditions. So all I'm, my message to those who want to replace Obamacare is you've got to keep the pre-existing condition prohibition in there, but you have to find a way to make it work economically. Otherwise, we're going to go back to a world which is going to really hurt entrepreneurship.
Right. I agree. I agree. Reducing consumption, increasing savings. If you look at any of the statistics I've seen, have you ever read Steve Roche's book Unbalanced about the U.S.-China relationship? It's one of my favorites from last year. You know, if you look at any of the statistics, and I'm thinking of the one Steve used, if you, you know, the imbalance in the United States between consumption and savings is extraordinary. And the question is, how do we improve it? And that is not only part of, you know, how do we readdress the balances with China and other countries, but how do we, you know, how do we come back to an economy which is productive and building? Any thoughts on how you think that's going to happen? Because so much of that works through the federal budget.
Yeah, I mean, you know, fortunately, and this has been a sort of a side effect of the financial crisis, the savings rates have gone up since the financial crisis.
Right, they have.
That's because people aren't spending. They don't have confidence in the economy. So we want people to save for good reasons, not for bad reasons. I think more financial education will help. And actually, I also think that moving more toward consumption taxes, which some Republicans, by the way, have advocated, you know, moving more in the direction of either a VAT or something that taxes consumption rather than income, would drive us in the direction of having more savings. So I think that's
right. I agree with you on that one. I live in a state with a very high sales tax and no income tax, and boy, people are much more economic here. It works. Okay, one of my near and dear to my heart is equity financing.
Yeah.
And I noticed you said a few words about the Jobs Act and crowdfunding, so maybe you could touch on that.
So crowdfunding was actually just approved just about a month or two ago. There was a provision in the Jobs Act that would allow these platforms like Kickstarter to go into equity financing, not just give you away trinkets and be the first in line, but you could actually have a share of a company. It took the SEC, I don't know, 3 or 4 years to write the rules, took them too long. And by the way, the rules may be too strict. I mean, we won't know.
Yeah, I think they're too strict.
I think they are too strict.
But
crowdfunding has tremendous promise if it were allowed. And I think that's one area where basically, you know, people say no pain, no gain. Well, in the world of entrepreneurship and growth, you know, no risk, no reward, you know.
Right.
And so people are so obsessed and so worried about people losing their money in investments that you write very, very tight rules and to try to prevent people from losing money will also prevent people from raising money to finance their companies. And I would rather err on the side of allowing more of this activity to take place and maybe, you know, some more people losing money than having a world in which basically there's no risk and no reward.
Well, the way I say it is I, you know, in very short order, I can leave my home and spend my life savings on the lottery. I can spend my life savings on hard narcotics. Neither of those are a problem. I can't invest in a venture pool for my community.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. So,
and so we may have to revisit this. And I actually think in 2017, maybe a new president could revisit whether or not the crowdfunding rules are too strict. And if they are, lighten up a bit.
One of the things I had not thought about until I read your book was Open Fuel Platform. Maybe you could say a few words of that. I found that very intriguing.
Well, I wrote it at a time when oil prices were very, very high, and the idea was there had been some people that have suggested that we have a mandate that new car engines be able to operate on multiple kinds of fuel so you're not just locked into gasoline. And so you could run on natural gas, you could run on, you know, hydrogen, et cetera. And That hasn't gone much anywhere because oil prices have dropped so rapidly. Well, this ought to be a good time to maybe think about perhaps mandating right. something like this so that when oil prices do rise again, people can switch. But it hasn't gotten traction for the reason I said.
Right. And finally, one you didn't bring up, but it's really come to the fore, and that is how to deal with student loans. Because if and this gets back to the fairness issue of bringing in foreign kids or giving them visas or green cards. You know, our current generation is loaded up with debt, or current young people are loaded up with student loan debt. And if you look at the terms and conditions of that debt, it's clearly unfair relative to what we're offering, you know, banks that get into trouble. So what do we do about the backlog of student loan debt?
Oh, that's a very good question. I've been more worried about sort of what we do for the new students. I mean, I'm a big supporter mm-hmm. of what's called the income contingent loan, which the administration has pushed. I had an income contingent loan when I went to graduate school, for example. Actually, it's a law school, excuse me, where basically, you know, your repayment is contingent on your income.
Right.
And it would be capped so that, you know, if you ended up paying, you know, more than 150% of your loan balance, you wouldn't have to pay anymore. So I think that in effect allows people, has the lender take an equity position in students. Marco Rubio, by the way, has a very innovative proposal. He would let private individuals finance other people and take equity interest up to a certain limit in other
right.
people's education. It's a very interesting idea. But I think the more we move in an equity direction so that people who, for example, fall on hard times and then basically are facing these huge student loan commitments, in an income contingent world, they wouldn't have to pay back so much when they're unemployed or when they have, you know,
right.
low income periods.
Are there any policy options that have been floated that would refinance current students to lower rates?
Not that I see of. I mean, you could imagine a world, for example, where you converted the existing loans into income contingent loans. But if you did that, you may have to have money, because you can't confiscate the loans. You just simply can't force
right.
somebody to change the loan.
Right.
So you may have to have some federal sweetener money that would go in. And I think most of these loans are now all securitized, right? They're all bundled up. So it's not as if they're held on bank balance sheets. They're held by pools, just
right.
like the mortgages. And so you'd end up having...
Right, it would have to be a refinancing option
yeah,
or a refunding
a, yeah.
option.
Yeah, and yeah. I think, though, it would... But if it did, and somebody elected to go from a fixed loan into an income contingent loan, the lender, as I said, may be hurt by that, and so you'd have to find a way to compensate the lender. It would be complicated to do.
Right, absolutely. Okay, wild cards. I certainly am watching in businesses that I'm connected to extraordinary rollout of new automation, including robotics. You know, it's happening at high speed, and the impact on productivity is very positive, very dramatic. So we hear all sorts of discussion of what is this going to mean to employment, to the economy. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not so worried about the employment impact as I am on the wage impact. Because people, I mean, eventually, if IT and robotics basically makes a lot of things cheaper, it means that, you know, the price of all kinds of things will fall. And as we
right.
as consumers will have more money to spend, so we'll spend on other things. So people will end up getting jobs in other fields. It's just that those other jobs may not pay as much as
right.
the ones they had before. And so really, this is an income issue. There's a great book written about this called Average is Over by Tyler Cowen. And it's a very disturbing book because it implies an 80-20 society where the 20% of people who know IT and are very facile with it get all the money and the people at the bottom 80 don't. And
right.
that is the world I fear that we're headed toward. And the only way to avoid that world is through education and making sure that as many people as possible are facile with IT. And that
right.
starts from the first grade. You know,
right.
And I actually think our school system ought to be overhauled, where kids learn how to code computers and they learn how to be facile with computers from the very earliest time that we teach them how to read and write.
Well, in the 90s, I really believe that technology was one of the great creators of inequality. But I've come to believe, and it's a much longer conversation, not for today, that a tremendous amount of the equality comes out of privileges created through the federal budget and federal mechanism. And, you know, which gets back to, you know, how do we keep the policy mechanism, you know, really focused on optimizing the whole economy and obeying law, which is gets us to this question of how do we rebuild trust in the system? Because I think, you know, if you said to me, what's the number one cause of deflation? I would say it's literally, whether it's big business or small business or entrepreneurs doing startup, the average American has very little faith left in the general system, whether it's business or government.
I know. I know. And it's a huge problem. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons why we see people moving to both extremes in both parties, because they've abandoned
right.
what they view as the establishment conventional wisdom. It's very unhealthy for democracy.
So the question, I'm always big on what's the action. What are the actions that we can take to rebuild the middle? And I propose we talk about some here. One is, I think, the more we could get transparency and accountability and accessibility in government budgets and finances and the policy process. So, you know, if you look at the policy process you described in the transportation example, you're talking about a fairly open process and a lot of open discussion among very smart people. But, you know, just we can't do that without the analytics. And I for one, you know, I've been beating the drum for 20 years for place-based disclosure of the federal budget and federal credit and all sorts of federal financial information. Because what I found is, you know, if you're going to re-optimize or re-engineer the economy in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, it's totally different than what you're going to do in Kansas or New York. You know, every place, there are 3,100 counties approximately, and everyone is unique. And it really comes down to, you know, who are the Fred Smiths and Elvis Presleys in your county, and how do you re-engineer things so that they can just fly?
So, you make a really good point. You make a good point about having disclosure and transparency. So a perfect example is not only show, you know, the aggregate impacts in terms of, you know, total spending and what it's going to do on the budget, but the distributional breakdown. So there are organizations like the Brookings Urban Institute Joint Tax Center, which shows the distributional impacts of various tax changes. But we ought to break these things down, for example, for very specific things like the mortgage interest reduction, which really,
right.
really benefits it benefits disproportionately the wealthy who have the highest tax rates. And so you
well,
were
it's interesting.
About, I mean, you were talking about, for example, how we perpetuate inequality from one generation to the next. Well, if you grow up in a rich neighborhood, you know, you're going to go to better schools, and obviously you're going to have a better chance in life.
Right.
Well, federal policy is tilted toward helping people who live in high-income areas because we give them larger tax deductions.
What's interesting, in 1996, one of the guys that I had worked well with in Wall Street was a guy named Luis Mendez, who was built the trading floor at Morgan Stanley and then came over to Dillon Reed and ran our capital markets. And I was trying to talk him into coming and doing some things at Hamilton, and he came down and he was bemoaning the fact that the federal government was hopeless for one reason or another. And so I said, I told him my hopes for place-based financial disclosure, and he said, oh, it's a complete waste of time. So I said, okay, Luis, where do you live? He said, Bronxville. So we pulled up the consolidated financial reports and some of the other data for Bronxville. Instead of letting him see it in numbers, we had GIS software. So he became fascinated, and he started to dig in and look at the sources and uses of government federal money in his place. And he lobbed on to flood insurance, and he said, $4 million for flood insurance? This is ridiculous. You know, Bronxville's on a hill. I've lived there for 30 years. There's no floods. Anyway, so I had a conference call with him the next morning. He flew back to New York, and he was late. And Luis is never late. He's always on time. So I finally got through to him 2 hours ago. I said, Luis, where have you been? And he said, I have been on the phone with the deputy mayor of Bronxville for 4 hours going through all these numbers, all this waste and corruption is going to stop. And I said, I thought you said it was hopeless. He said, that's before I had the numbers on my neighborhood. And, you know, and so I don't know if you've ever fought. I'm sure you've seen participatory budgeting. But what I find is that if you give somebody all the statistics on, you know, on the sources and uses of governmental funds within their place, ideally federal, state, and local, and you ask them to reoptimize, they will come up, you know, it will be very quirky and unique what trade-offs that they will do. And part of it has got to be cross-sector. So when I said, you know, your experience is so good for this time, you know, you're talking about mind-boggling cross-sector, sort of decisions and ideas that have to be considered. And that's the advantage of letting local guys start to grapple with, okay, how are you going to make these choices? And I don't see how they start to come back with proposals. You know, I think there are a lot of proposals where if small business got together and said, okay, how could we lower the burden on the taxpayer, particularly in an environment of cuts? You know, I think they would start coming up with a lot of ideas, but that's not going to happen unless they feel safe to do that and the analytics are available.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Information is power. Yep.
Right. Well, that's why I think this idea of the revolution in economics is so interesting, because that if you apply that revolution to the statistics and analytics we have bottom up on the economy, you know, to how we re-engineer the federal budget, I, for one, think there's a lot more money and growth potential than, you know, than a lot of people just sitting in Washington saying, how are we going to cut, cut, cut? So, you know, if we loosen the rules, we can, you know, we can change a lot of things. One quick thing I wanted to bring up before we close, and that is environmental stress. To me, that's one of the wild cards. It's one you talk about. I'm one of those people who believes you can't trust the system to implement cap and trades.
Yeah.
I'm violating.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think it will get politically distorted. And by the way, it probably won't happen in any event.
Oh, well, that's good news. Oh.
Well, the economist's preferred solution, solution to all this, of course, is having a carbon tax and then letting the market figure it out. And you could get, in theory, you could get rid of a lot of regulation if you just put a price on carbon. And then the markets would settle this out. You know, you'd have more incentives for clean fuels and disincentives for dirty fuels. But we know the politics of a carbon tax, even with a rebate, for example, for low-income people.
Right.
They get hurt by it. Still, the politics are terrible. My own personal view is that if climate change gets to be so bad that people are so upset with it, I actually think we're going to end up with this. We will end up with one of these geoengineering solutions, low-cost way. You know, these ideas of putting sulfur in the air and that way, depleting the sunlight and so forth. And I know there are a lot of risks to it, but it's also very cheap. And I think the world will not spend the massive amounts of money that conventional analysis holds to reduce carbon. I think we'll end up using a stopgap measure, but we're probably years away from that.
Well, let me also make a pitch, because I absolutely believe that if you had equity-based, place-based vehicles, so this is why it was one of the reasons I was so interested in venture funds and REITs for your place, then you've created an enormous equity incentive for people to significantly reduce consumption and integrate new technology. And so you could have something a lot more market-based than cap and trade, I think, would end up being. So, you know, let me make a pitch again for all the good things you've tried to do for equity financing, because the more, you know, the more the economy finances with equity, particularly on a place-based basis, the more, you know, the environmental stress, you know, makes sense to heal, and you can make money reducing consumption. So anyway, that's my pitch. Okay, so what about Bob? How do we follow you? How do we get your books? You've got a Twitter feed. How do we follow your work?
Well, I'm at Bob Lytan, B-O-B-L-I-T-A-N on Twitter. And I irregularly have a blog for the Wall Street Journal on I think it's called our Capital Finance page. It's on their online thing. And I, irregularly but occasionally produce more new stuff. I'm currently working on a short book on sort of the history of the financial system over the last 30 years for the American Enterprise Institute. Hopefully it'll be out in the 2016.
Fabulous.
The future work that I probably be spending a lot of time on is how can cities in particular encourage more entrepreneurial behavior by their residents. And so that interests me greatly, because a lot of my work at Kauffman was about entrepreneurship, and if you look at all cities in the world, cities are built on the strength of entrepreneurs. And if you've got a vibrant entrepreneurial community, you've got a great city. And if you don't, you don't. And so finding ways to harness entrepreneurial energy and talent at the city level, to me, is a promising line of research interest.
There's a great DVD called New York, New York, sort of on the history of New York. Mm-hmm. And my firm in New York used to do a lot of underwriting for Bob Moses. And one of the things they show is they show how Moses, with a lot of these big projects, would generate enormous fees for his friends, but would shut down the entrepreneurial economy. And at one point in the 70s, just really hammered it. And they've got Jane Jacobs on making her, you know, brilliant presentation about the economics of cities and the entrepreneurial strength of cities and what this was all doing. And it really shows you in a very fun, dynamic way the conversation about that topic. So my last question for you was going to be, if money was no object, you could spend whatever you wanted on research, do whatever you wanted. I was going to ask you what would the research you would next either do or serve as the patron for?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. You know, I'm biased toward entrepreneurship, but it depends heavily on the data. But I guess this is just a general point. I want to know a lot more on how to encourage more entrepreneurial behavior and what makes for entrepreneurial success. If we can more identify that relationship, so if I know your characteristics, what's your probability you'll become an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, and especially, to what extent will your business or whatever contribute to growth in the economy? All those linkages to me are vitally important for the future of the economy.
Right. Right, and very, very helpful for the educators.
One hopes so.
Okay, well, Bob Lytan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us on the Saleri Report. You have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you so much, Austin. Great.